Today is Wednesday, June 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, tensions continue to build up between the U.S. and Iran, as officials say they don't want war.
I know that the soldiers, sailors, and airmen and Marines inside of CENTCOM are ready to respond to any threat that the Islamic of Iran should present to the United States.
The president is ramping up a call to deport millions in the U.S. illegally. Also ahead, more than 150 guitars used by a very famous band member are going up for auction. It's all on today's International Edition. Top U.S. military and diplomatic officials say they have no intention of easing their maximum pressure campaign against Iran, even as evidence suggests the regime in Tehran is lashing out in increasingly dangerous ways. Concern about a potential confrontation between the United States and Iran has been growing since last week's attacks on two oil tankers in the Strait of Hormuz, which the U.S. says is the work of Iran. President Trump was asked about it by reporters on Tuesday.
They've been a nation of terror. Now we'll see what happens. We'll see what happens. They are a much different country today than they were 2.5 years ago when I came into office.
But despite the rising tensions in the Middle East, U.S. officials caution they're not looking to start a war. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo addressed reporters Tuesday while visiting with military leaders at U.S. Central Command in Tampa, Florida.
President Trump does not want war, and we will continue to communicate that message while doing the things that are necessary to protect American interests in the region.
Iran has said it will not abide by a limit on uranium stockpiles established under a 2015 international deal and signed by former President Barack Obama in exchange for easing sanctions. But Trump withdrew from the deal, and now the U.S. finds itself in the position of demanding Iran comply with a deal that Trump derides as the worst in history.
It's been our mission since the beginning of this administration to convince the Iranian regime not to move forward with their nuclear program and not to continue to engage in development of their missiles and all the other activities, the malign activities that they've been engaged in around the world.
But Democratic Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer says the American people are confused and concerned about what's happening.
I don't know what their strategy is, and it doesn't seem consistent. It seems when the president wakes up one morning, he says something, and then 2 days later he says something else. One day he says he's going to obliterate them, and the next day he says he wants to talk to them.
Meanwhile, the United States has denied new claims by Iranian officials that Tehran and its allies have dismantled a U.S. cyber spying network as part of a purported operation that led to multiple arrests of U.S. agents. In a Tuesday statement issued in response to a query by VOA Persian, a U.S. official who declined to be identified, disputed Iran's assertions that it recently successfully targeted a U.S. spy network. Meanwhile, Acting Defense Secretary Patrick Shanahan has withdrawn his quest for the top Pentagon job as reports emerged of domestic violence in his family. The withdrawal plunges leadership of the U.S. military into new uncertainty just as tensions with Iran are rising. VOA Chief White House Correspondent Steve Herman reports.
Speaking to reporters on the South Lawn, Trump acknowledged violent domestic incidents years ago in the Shanahan family prompted the acting defense secretary to take himself out of the running for the permanent position.
But I did not ask him to withdraw. He presented me with a letter this morning. That was his decision.
The president added the process to nominate Esper could occur quickly. There's been no confirmed defense secretary since Jim Mattis resigned last December. Steve Herman, VOA News, at the White House.
Russian news agencies Monday said the Kremlin has uncovered and thwarted attempts by the United States to carry out cyber attacks on Russian infrastructure control systems. The disclosure followed a New York Times report citing unnamed government sources as saying that the U.S. had inserted potentially disruptive computer code into Russia's power grid as part of a more aggressive deployment of its cyber tools. And it also follows growing concerns that Russia is or will again conduct cyber warfare on the 2020 U.S. presidential election. Joining us to talk more about this report in the New York Times and all of this is Annie Fixler, Deputy Director of Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, Center on Cyber and Technology Innovation. Thanks for being with us. So you've written that if the New York Times report is actually accurate, it would reflect a recognition by the U.S. that our previous efforts to thwart cyber attacks have not been sufficient. Is that the case?
It's a complicated picture, but the most important thing that I take away from this story is a reminder that Russia is a malicious cyber actor. As you mentioned, their involvement in election interference, both in the United States as well as they've been doing these kinds of social media operations throughout Europe as well. But beyond, you could call influence operations or information warfare, they conduct cyber attacks that have significant tangible and real-world impact. The intelligence community has called Russia a highly capable and effective adversary that is capable of causing localized and temporary disruptions to U.S. critical infrastructure. Hmm. And we saw that in Ukraine in 2015 and 2016 when Russia disrupted electricity for more than 200,000 people in Ukraine. In the United States, we've also heard of Russian infiltration of the U.S. power grid. The FBI and Department of Homeland Security have repeatedly issued alerts and warnings about Russian government-sponsored activity in this regard.
Yeah, I would imagine a targeting power grids would do significant harm here in the U.S. And certainly if we retaliated and did that in Russia, although I've never heard of the U.S. doing that.
Why we might be doing that, and obviously this report is detailed but doesn't clarify exactly how the United States would have done this, and the U.S. government would not confirm whether or not we've done this. If this operation is occurring, it's likely highly classified. But in short, what the United States would be doing is trying to implant malware in the Russian electric grid as a way to establish deterrence. Up until now, the United States has failed to establish deterrence in cyberspace against its adversaries. Anytime you pick up the newspaper, the latest report about another cyber breach, another attack, another infiltration, our adversaries are running rampant in cyberspace. The U.S. Department of Defense has said that it will deter, it's one of its goals is to deter cyber adversaries, but we're clearly not. The National Defense Strategy Commission, which is a bipartisan congressionally mandated commission, concluded that, and these are their words, it's painfully clear that America is not competing or deterring its adversaries effectively as it should in cyberspace. So the way the implanting malware in the Russian electric grid would work in terms of deterrence is the idea being that Russia could see that the United States has, to a certain extent, pre-positioned cyber weapons in the Russian system, and it would deter Russia from conducting operations lest we then trigger those weapons.
What do you think that the U.S. should do at this point if, in fact, we are trying to sort of deter Russia or any other hostile foreign government from attacking our power grids and, you know, any sort of cyber warfare?
The most important thing I think we need to keep in mind is that we don't need to confine our responses in cyber to cyber. We should be expanding the domain and responding in areas where the United States has asymmetric advantages. So the United States has significant cyber vulnerabilities. If we escalate solely in the cyber domain, we are leaving ourselves open to additional attacks. But the United States has asymmetric advantages when it comes to the use of economic sanctions and things like federal indictments, which we have deployed against Russia to address its malicious cyber activity to a certain extent, but much more could be done to target the financial networks that are enabling Russia's malicious activity, both in cyber and arguably in their other domains where they are also working against U.S. interests.
How confident are you that we are able to stop any attempt at doing this type of thing to our power grid?
That's the million-dollar question. The United States government has tried to improve its information sharing with the private sector to prevent malicious attacks from causing systemic problems, from cascading effects. And with different sectors of the economy, those results are mixed. Information sharing generally with the financial sector and within and between financial institutions is quite robust. In general, the sharing with the energy sector and the electric grid in particular sort of is second in the ranking, but it falls off pretty quickly after that. So information sharing to other sectors of the economy and information sharing within those sectors to understand the cyber threat actors, to understand vectors that these actors use to cause disruptive attack, that sharing of information is far less robust than it needs to be.
All right, that's Annie Fixler, Deputy Director of Foundation at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies on Cyber and Technology Innovation. President Donald Trump is promising to start deporting millions of immigrants who are in the U.S. illegally. But the announced raids on immigrant families appear to have caught the country's immigration officials by surprise. Immigration attorney Annabelle Alvarez.
Last night, the president tweeted that ICE will begin mass deportations next week. We know exactly why he tweeted that, because he knew we were coming to Orlando and he knew these workers were here with the truth. He is afraid of these workers. This is the one story the administration doesn't talk about. The undocumented immigrants who worked for Donald Trump in his house for many, many years. These are the same people he vilifies.
Raids on the scale Trump has described could require thousands of law enforcement personnel, but many immigration agents have already been diverted to the U.S. southern border to control the surge of migrants crossing over from Mexico, more than 140,000 in May alone. U.S. immigration officials say despite Trump's announcement, raids on migrant families are not imminent. Reports say the officials were unaware Trump was planning to disclose sensitive law enforcement actions on Twitter. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. The U.S. and China will resume trade talks ahead of a Trump-Xi meeting. The Taliban and the U.S. have agreed to full troop withdrawal from Afghanistan. Over 16 tons of cocaine intercepted at a Philadelphia port. And Facebook plans its own currency for 2 billion plus users. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Hong Kong's pro-Beijing leader Carrie Lam offered an apology Tuesday for the political crisis and unrest sparked by a proposed law that would allow extraditions to mainland China. But she did not give in to the protesters' demands that she leave office over her handling of the controversial bill, though she did put the proposal on hold.
So in the next 3 years, while it is difficult, as I said, the difficulty lies now perhaps not in the matter of ability or competence, but in the trust amongst the people of Hong Kong. So myself and my team, we will try our very best to rebuild that trust so that we can continue to implement these social and economic policies. As I said, my commitment is to doing all this important work in the next 3 years.
Opposition to the bill has driven mass protests in Hong Kong this month. Organizers said 2 million people turned out Sunday. Many protesters and pro-democracy legislators see the plan as an infringement on Hong Kong's autonomy. The U.S. voiced new support Monday for the protesters. State Department spokesperson Morgan Ortega said the demonstrators were engaged in peaceful protests for things which are enshrined in basic law.
It certainly was moving, I think, as a citizen and a democracy to watch these peaceful protests happen in Hong Kong. And we're seeing the people there in Hong Kong, of course, demonstrating for their basic rights, for the rights of freedom of speech, for freedom of assembly, all of these things which are enshrined into basic law. And so, of course, as we observe these, we continue to call on the Hong Kong government to address the concerns of their public, to consult with local and international stakeholders who may be affected by this proposed amendment, even though I know it, of course, has been postponed.
And while Hong Kong authorities may have put a pause on voting on the controversial extradition bill, many citizens are concerned China is slowly encroaching on their rights of autonomy and tightening its grip on the territory. But as VOA's Bill Gallo reports, there is still widespread concern about Hong Kong's future.
Hong Kong won't fully become part of China until 2047, almost three decades from now. But many in this semi-autonomous city say their way of life is already changing as Beijing expands its influence here.
At the heart of the latest protests here was an intensely personal question. Would you trust being sent to stand trial in China's politicized judicial system? The answer from Hong Kongers was a resounding no.
An estimated 2 million people attended the latest protest against the government's extradition proposal. That's over a quarter of Hong Kong's population, a forceful repudiation of China's judicial system. Though the government paused the bill, Hong Kong's future remains uncertain. As Beijing closes in, many feel they have no choice but to consider leaving.
It is happening. It is already happening. People of my age, like in their late 30s, 40s,
are already planning, and they are already looking around.
Maybe somewhere western, more democratic.
Yeah, I will feel ashamed that I will not like to live in here anymore.
We will go to Taiwan or Australia, somewhere that not yet controlled by China.
Hong Kong's reputation as an international financial hub could also be at risk.
One of the reasons why people like using Hong Kong as an Asia base is that on the one hand they can get access to the China market, but on the other hand it's a separate legal system with greater protections for the rule of law and greater protections for private property and the like. If you open any hole to allow the Chinese legal system to creep in, that would obviously have an implication.
Though there's been no rush for the exits, the business community's concern about the extradition law was genuine.
The American Chamber of Commerce, the British Chamber of Commerce, the European Chamber of Commerce all have expressed considerable concern about this. So from the business community immediately recognized that this was it was completely contrary to one country, two systems principle.
Since Hong Kong lacks fully democratic institutions, one of the only ways people here can push back is through protest. And at this point, the protests only keep getting bigger. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Hong Kong.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. voanews.com.
VOA's International Edition continues. Experienced and aspiring architects of all kinds from around the world are vying for a prestigious architecture award. The Architecture Master Prize Competition 2019 celebrates innovative architectural designs, firms, and products from around the world. I talked to one of the organizers, David Terra, about what the competition entails.
The Architecture Master Prize is a global architecture award, and the mission of the organization is to advance the appreciation of quality architecture. So the AMP celebrates creativity and innovation in the fields of architectural design, interior design, and landscape design. The mission of the AMP is to advance the appreciation of quality architecture worldwide and to celebrate the greatest achievements in architecture, interior design, and landscape design, and to showcase the world-class talent and visionaries of these fields and provide them with great publicity.
Landscape architecture or any kind of architecture, buildings and things like that?
Architectural design, so buildings, interior design, and landscape architecture. So these are the three main categories we have, and we have 41 subcategories.
I imagine that because this is an international competition, you will be getting submissions from all over the world.
Yes, we are getting submissions from architects from everywhere, from Asia to the U.S., Europe, everywhere.
How many submissions in total do you expect to get overall? How many have you gotten in the past?
We generally get over 1,000 submissions per year. And this year is a little bit of a special year. We have three different programs running. So one of them is the Architectural Designs of the Year, which celebrates the greatest project of individual architectural designs, interior designs, and landscape designs. And we have the Architectural Firm of the Year. And we have a third one, which is Architectural Products. So I think we have created a very, very comprehensive program that is celebrating all the different parts and elements of great architecture.
And what are the prizes?
The prize is mostly the recognition that the architect gets by being recognized by the organization. They receive a beautiful trophy, certificate. We have a big party every year somewhere else. The first 2 years were in New York at the Cooper Hewitt Museum and one at the New Museum. And this year we are at the Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao, Spain.
What sorts of things do people submit? Do they submit plans? Is that how it works with an architecture contest? Or photographs? Or is it like plans?
It is up to the architect what they submit to us. And they are encouraged to present their projects and buildings or their firm or their product the best way possible. The jury can assess the value, the level of innovation, creativity, and usefulness of their creations.
All right, that's David Tarrow, one of the organizers of the Architecture Master Prize 2019. More than 160 guitars played and owned by Pink Floyd guitarist David Gilmour will go on auction in New York. VOA's David Byrd has a look at this collection, which helped make some of the most iconic songs in rock and roll.
David Gilmour's number one instrument, a black Fender Stratocaster, as well as a white Fender Strat and a Gibson Les Paul he used for Pink Floyd's iconic hit, Another Brick in the Wall, are all part of the auction at Christie's. Gilmour has said he considers the guitars as tools of his trade and will use the money to benefit his charities, which fight hunger and homelessness. Kerry Keene is Christie's musical instruments specialist.
The values pre-sale estimates range anywhere between $300 to $150,000. And there are three instruments that carry the highest estimates. It is the Black Strat, estimated at $100,000 to $150,000. It is an extremely rare Gretsch White Penguin, again, estimated at $100,000 to $150,000. And it's the White Strat 0001. Which also carries an estimate of $100,000 to $150,000. And those are sort of the great jewels of the sale.
Caitlin Graham is the Christie's pop music consultant.
David Gilmour purchased the Black Strat at Manny's Music in New York in 1970, and it quickly became his primary guitar. It was instrumental in the recording of Dark Side of the Moon, Pink Floyd's masterpiece album. And for the follow-up albums, Wish You Were Here, Animals, and The Wall, which really are the sort of four cornerstones of the classic era Pink Floyd. Running over the same old ground, what have we found? Same old
fears, wish you were here. Graham says a Martin acoustic guitar that Gilmour used for the band's hit Wish You Were Here is also on the auction block.
A 1969 Martin D35 acoustic guitar, which David Gilmour purchased on the street from a person hawking a guitar outside Manny's Music in 1971. And it quickly became his primary studio guitar for both Pink Floyd and his solo recordings for the next sort of 40 years up to this day. It was used to record Wish You Were Here in 1975, which Rolling Stone calls Pink Floyd's most enduring composition. And I suspect that it might be David Gilmour's favorite guitar.
Kerry Keene of Christie's says the proceeds will go to Gilmour's foundation and charity.
He's a great believer in giving away these riches, and he wants to help out both world hunger and homelessness. Those are two very deep passions for him. Money!
David Gilmour will not be present for the auction, but said in a statement that he hopes that by auctioning the guitars that he can give some help where it is really needed and through my charitable foundation do some good in this world. In Washington, I'm David Byrd, VOA News.
Pop star Ariana Grande has officially launched a clothing collection at H&M retail clothing stores. The Grammy-winning singer collaborated with a Swedish clothing company to create a variety of designs from pastel tones to tie-dyed outfits, some with lyrics to her songs right on the fabric. One ivory-colored hoodie promotes her latest album, Sweetener, which is also the title of her current world tour. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day. Plus I met someone else. We having better discussions. I know they say I move on too fast, but this one gon' last. 'Cause her name is Ari, and I'm so good with that. So good with she that. Taught me love. She taught me patience. She handles pain. That's amazing. I've loved and I lost, but that's not what I feel. Look what I found. Thanking my dad, 'cause she grew from the drama. Only wanna do it once real bad. Gonna make that last. God forbid something happens. At least this song is a smash. I got so much love, got so much patience. Learned from the pain. Turned out amazing.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
An estimated 8 million metric tons of plastic pour into the oceans every year, amounting to the equivalent of one garbage truck every minute, USAID Counselor Chris Milligan told a crowd at the Wilson Center in Washington, D.C. this week.
There are now five massive patches of floating garbage in the world's oceans. We found microplastics in the Arctic sea ice, at the most remote stretches of islands in the Pacific, and in the deepest ocean trenches.
Most ocean plastics come from land-based sources, said Councillor Milligan.
An enormous amount comes from cities in the developing world, which cannot adequately manage their waste. And this includes a number of cities in the rapidly urbanizing countries of South and Southeast Asia. Ocean plastic waste is a global problem, but waste management is a local issue.
That is why USAID has joined forces with Circulate Capital, a firm dedicated to incubating and financing companies and infrastructure that prevent ocean plastic pollution. The firm's funding is backed by $100 million in commitments from numerous multinational corporations, including PepsiCo, Procter & Gamble, Dow, Danone, Unilever, and Coca-Cola. In what is called a blended finance agreement, USAID will provide Circulate Capital with $35 million, 50% loan portfolio guarantee. This will help lessen risk for private investors and incentivize private capital investment and new business development in recycling trash collection and related businesses in Indonesia, the Philippines, Sri Lanka, and Vietnam. This program will create a new recycling market in these countries, making plastics too valuable to dump into the ocean. Our goal, said Councillor Milligan, is to promote a partner's self-reliance so that they can participate in the world economy as equals and join us in addressing global challenges.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
This is VOA.